A seat at the table today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Brazil, a growing number of black women are running for office. Many were spurred into action by the murder of Rio lawmaker Marielle Franco.
These women are acting on Marielle's belief that to change politics, you have to have a seat at the table.
Changing politics is also the mantra of Ayanna Pressley. Her primary victory last night here in Massachusetts made history. She's now poised to become the first black woman to represent the state in Congress.
She said to so many, "I see you. You whose English is not your primary language. I see you. I know who to talk to that can reach out to you and make you understand that you count."
Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We get into today's show with a very local story, but as you expect from us, we're also going to take the local and look at it globally. Like the historic victory of Ayanna Pressley last night, right here in the 7th Congressional District of Massachusetts. That made headlines across this country. It was also news in Brazil.
The victory has been covered a bit in Brazilian media, and it may indeed become a talking point just about the need to have more women of color in positions of power. And the idea that this benefit to society is a global wave, not just something that's happening in an isolated way.
We'll hear more from reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio in just a bit. But let's begin with the Boston crest of that global wave. This was an electoral win that surprised pollsters. Ayanna Pressley, a Boston city councilor, defeated 10-term incumbent Michael Capuano by 17 percentage points. That sets up Pressley to be the first woman of color to represent the state in Congress, because there's no challenger for the November election. Marie Saint-Fleur was rooting for her. Saint-Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative. She was the first Haitian-American elected to state office in the U.S., and she later worked in Boston City Hall with the late mayor, Thomas Menino. Marie Saint-Fleur, how are you feeling about this upset victory?
Delighted. Absolutely delighted. Historical evening.
Historic. And why did you support Pressley?
I support Pressley because change can't wait, because she represents the lived experience of 60% of the people who live in the district. I respect Michael Capuano. I've supported Michael Capuano in the past. But there are specific issues that need to be addressed that need different lens. And the more diverse, the more inclusive your representation is, the better results we can get to for all people.
Yeah, a couple of those issues just off the top of your head.
Well, let's talk about affordable housing, right? If you talk about affordable housing and just look at it through the most consistent lens, then you're going to pass policies that are the regular run of the mill. But if I look at a district where a majority of the population, 60%, are underemployed, you have a significant demographic that culturally are not used to going anywhere to government to ask for help. That language may not predominantly be English. I need to think about how I'm going to pass that policy so that it's accessible to all people. And so you need somebody who's going to think about that. We have the issues around girls. What is happening with girls in the state and in that district in order to make certain that they have access to health care? And so you need someone who's going to be thinking about that in a proactive way, because the existing systems have kept them out.
Beyond Massachusetts, with wins by Pressley and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York, how would you describe the momentum right now on the national stage?
I think the Democratic Party needs to wake up and listen to this new group of people that are saying business as usual is not acceptable. I think they're saying that there's a swath of people who have been silent. And you know what? After a while, you can keep a person down for just so long. And after a while, they're not going to take it anymore. And I think that is what all this is saying right now. There's this swell of energy that has been created, and they've been reached out to. And I think Ayanna said it last night. She said to so many, "I see you. You whose English is not your primary language. I see you. I know who to talk to that can reach out to you and make you understand that you count. You who understand that you've been marginalized and the economy has not been working for you. I see you. Come join hands with me. Let me help you tell your story so we can bring real change." And I think that's what happened in New York. I think that's what's happened in other states where we've seen this change coming. And it's coming in Georgia as well with Ms. Abrams.
So Democrats need to wake up. Has the party machinery not been responsive enough to candidates like Ayanna Pressley?
I know people dislike when I say that. I just say that the Democrats and the Republicans are different sides of the same coin. Even though our aspirations, I don't know if our aspirations are different, our methodologies might be different. At the end of the day, we've gotten into a place in America where it's not about people, it's about keeping a system in place, right? So at the end of the day, if we would just be Americans and figure out what it is that we can do in order to better lives of everybody, I think that the people who are screaming to be heard will support people. I think what they've seen is that a good number of people who are not part of that club have felt that they've been left out. I think that's the message that's being said, particularly women of color. I think that's been said. I mean, we have been the backbone of the Democratic Party. No matter what has happened, we've come out and we've voted. Yet the Democratic Party did not see fit to support most of the black women that put their names up on that ballot. And so what they've said is, okay, I don't have to talk to you, establishment. I can go talk directly to the people because the people want to be heard. And that's exactly what's happening across the country. They're bypassing party. They're putting new structures in place to talk to people. Because you know what? Haitian people are not going to go to the Boston Globe, but they're going to go to Haitian radio. Brazilians are not going to go to the Globe, but they're going to go to their local papers. The Chinese are not going to necessarily go to the Globe. They're going to go to their local papers. They're going to go to their local radio stations. And if you care about me, you're going to talk through my medium so you could hear me, so you could see me, so you could, I could be part of the solution with you. And that's what this new group is saying.
Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative. Thanks very much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
So let's take a look at this trend in Brazil. Reporter Catherine Osborne traces it back a few years when Marielle Franco ran for the city council in Rio de Janeiro. She was expected to get something like 7,000 votes. Instead, Franco got more than 46,000.
She was part of a wave of candidates across the country who had run explicitly on black feminist platforms, which really is new in Brazil. Black activism has been around for several decades, and feminism goes back decades. But since 2013 in Brazil, they've mixed together more.
Black feminism, though, took a tragic hit in March when Marielle Franco was assassinated in Rio and she was leaving a political event. But that tragedy seemed to supercharge black feminist candidates in Brazil. Catherine Osborne wrote an item for Roads and Kingdoms that profiles some of the black women candidates in the upcoming elections there. So how is this growing effort in Brazil to elect black women candidates? How is that connected to the story of Marielle Franco?
One thing that Marielle frequently said while in office was that, "I can't do this alone. There need to be more of us." She would show up with proposals about maternal health care, proposals about public security, and she would face big conservative blocks of legislators in Rio City Council. And figures like her across the nation said that too. So Franco herself personally encouraged many of the candidates in this election to run. And these women are acting on Marielle's belief that to change politics, you have to have a seat at the table. Hmm. Protesting is important. Entrepreneurship is important. Civil society is important. But at the end of the day, if you're able to legislate about these issues, that just moves them so much further than if you aren't. The fear of many people after Franco was assassinated was that that would scare black Brazilians and specifically feminists from participating in politics. But instead, a chant that we've heard a lot since then is, "You tried to kill an ant, but you stepped on the anthill."
In the primaries here in the U.S., we've been seeing a range of reactions from the Democratic Party about black women candidates. There's been, at best, a lack of support, at worst, a complete disregard for the candidates, with the Democratic political machine really clinging to the incumbent. How has Brazil's political machines treated these black women candidates?
There's a lot of talk in Brazil about sort of empty gestures at trying to get more diverse people into politics. There are gender quotas that say parties are required to put forth 30% female candidates in each election. And in recent years, researchers have discovered that a lot of parties have been doing what is called here ghost candidates, which is you register a woman, but she sometimes doesn't even know she's a candidate. And then she gets zero votes on election day. And she learns she was on the ballot. And so there's all sorts of ways of paying lip service to diversity. Mm. And In this election, some parties have showed that they're going to actually give more institutional support to these kinds of candidates. There's still controversies about how much money these candidates are given, because even though now, according to a new regulation, 30% of parties' funds have to go to women candidates for the first time in this election, there's no rule about how that's going to be distributed. So will it be more to white women? Will it be more to women who are incumbents as opposed to first-time candidates? Those are some of the issues that researchers are watching.
Is there any suggestion that this is going to be another moment in October with this election for political upsets in Brazil?
It's certainly a moment of high dissatisfaction with the status quo. Over 50 sitting Congress people are being investigated for corruption. So there are all the ingredients for an upset. If an upset doesn't happen, I think researchers will point to these structural issues about the short length of the campaign, about the importance of funding and party backing. Because as much as some parties are taking this excitement about Black female candidates seriously, others are not. And so we may see a handful of new faces. And as Marielle Franco's case showed, it only takes a handful, and it only takes one very energized and very inspirational person to make a big difference.
Incidentally, the investigation into the killing of Marielle Franco is ongoing, and I followed up my conversation with Catherine Osborne, asking her about the latest.
The murder is now at least 5 months without being resolved. Investigators have said that she was killed for her political positions, but that could have included anything from her general activism against police violence to the fact that she was on the city council committee that would report military abuse of force in a military takeover of Rio's public security right now. Civil society is pretty horrified with the lack of resolution of the case, especially because Brazil's police and investigators have high technology tools that they could be using to resolve this. One high-ranking official in the investigation said that what was making it more difficult was the involvement of political figures in planning the assassination. So there's clearly people who don't want the truth to get out about what happened. And there are monthly protests still asking for an answer. Human rights organizations around the world are sort of raising a red flag about how bad it is that this has not been resolved, and that it's a lack of political will and not a lack of technical capacity.
Reporter Catherine Osborne speaking with us from Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on the show tomorrow, a conversation about American veterans. Journalist C.J. Chivers is a Marine veteran himself, and he'll be dropping by our studio to talk about his new book, The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those two long wars have seriously impacted American troops. Here at The World, we regularly turn to you in our virtual community of veterans for feedback, and we sent out a message this morning asking if your combat experience took a psychological toll. The response we got back was overwhelmingly yes. Tyler from Portland, Oregon wrote us saying, quote, "Even to this day, I'm leery of those I don't know. I feel different than others." And Aaron from Temecula, California responded with, quote, "Yes, combat in Iraq absolutely changed me. The person I was before I deployed has never come back home." If you're a veteran of the Iraq or Afghanistan wars, we want to hear from you. Did your combat experience take a psychological toll? Just text the word RETURN to the number 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. And thanks. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Here's a story out of the UK that caught our attention today. A debate in Parliament over a measure that would make misogyny a hate crime. This was an amendment to a larger bill to ban upskirting, as in secretly snapping a photo up a woman's skirt. Here's more from our BBC colleague, Nick Miles.
The legal idea that crime should be considered more abhorrent because of why they're carried out is a relatively recent one. In the UK, it was only in 1998 that racial hate crimes were defined, and 2003 when a crime motivated by a victim's sexuality was taken into account. Judges instruct juries to consider this hate element when deciding how long perpetrators should spend in prison. Until now, though, misogyny has not had an official status when it comes to criminal acts. That's in spite of the fact that numerous recent surveys suggest the majority of women have suffered public acts of misogyny, from unwanted sexual comments to tirades of verbal abuse.
I was on my way to work on my own, young single female. A man shouted a very aggressive sexual comment at me, and it was quite horrible language that he used.
This guy comes up to me and he like tries to touch me, tries to grab me, and then he was like, "Oh, you're such a slut." And
that's a video put out by one of the UK's regional police forces, North Yorkshire. Last year, it started considering misogynistic behaviour as either a hate crime or incident. It means abuse or harassment, which might not be a crime, can be reported and investigated by the police and support for the victim put in place. Nottingham Police did something similar in 2016. The law being considered, though, at Westminster today would go further. It would allow a sentencing judge to take into account if the offender demonstrated towards the victim of the offence hostility, based on them having a particular sex characteristic. Charlotte Fisher is from the community group Citizens UK. She's been leading their campaign to make misogyny a hate crime.
I guess what I hope is that by the time we get to the era of my grandchildren, that they will look back at what women in 2018 go through and just call life with just as much horror as I look back at, you know, how people behaved in the 1940s and the kind of racial epithets that people would use on the street very casually.
There's been widespread debate about this proposed change. Surveys show the majority of people, both men and women, favour it. But changing the law will, of course, not necessarily lead to a change in behaviour. That's a long-term educational challenge that's being undertaken in schools. Most British children went back to school this week, and this year they're going to be taking new classes on healthy relationships and sexual consent.
The BBC's Nick Miles reporting there, and there's an update to this story. Late in the day, UK time, the British government announced it would launch a review of hate crime laws, including whether misogynistic behavior should be considered a hate crime. As a result, the lawmaker who pushed for the misogyny amendment that we just heard about has withdrawn the bill. Can you imagine waking up to the news that the Departments of Energy, Agriculture, along with seven other cabinet departments, had all suddenly shut down? That's exactly what happened in Argentina this week. The country is desperately trying to balance its books. The BBC's Daniel Gallis joins us from Buenos Aires. What is going on in Argentina, Daniel?
Well, Argentina is a country that basically has been spending too much money for too long, so now it's having to drastically cut on everything that it can. This week, we heard the announcement of all these ministries shutting down. Some of them are not really effectively shutting down. They're just going to be, you know, transferred into other ministries and transformed into secretaries or smaller departments. But it's still all about slashing spending. The government has been doing this for quite some time. The government used to subsidize electricity bills, gas bills for the population. Even football broadcasting was subsidized by the government, and that's been all drastically cut. It's all in an attempt to show that Argentina will come up with the money that it needs to pay off its debts.
So what kinds of savings will the government get for slashing the number of government departments basically in half?
It's not very clear yet because they haven't really mapped out how much money they'll get from each department, but it's all part of comprehensive reforms that they announced this week. And it's not just about cutting spending, but also increasing taxes. Argentina is hoping to balance its budget by next year, and that's all to show international investors that Argentina is serious. There is still hope that they can settle this now because they basically have a pro-market government that's doing all the reforms that the international bankers want Argentina to do. So there's a lot of people still trying to save Argentina's economy before we get to that stage of a default. It's more a question of whether it will work or not now.
Won't this move to shut down these ministries have a knock-on effect on the services, though, for the public?
Yes, definitely. It's going to affect the lives of Argentinians, and it has been affecting for some time already. We've seen that, you know, especially in the health and education departments, basically teachers, doctors, they all need salaries, and these wages haven't been going up for some time. Because of all of this, Argentina is now expected to enter recession later this year.
In the meantime, Argentina is counting on a $50 billion bailout from the IMF.
Well, that money is already secured. But now what Argentina wants is for the IMF to actually quicken the payments of this $50 billion loan package, because it is having a pretty serious liquidity problem. There's more money going out of Argentina than coming in, and the peso has been losing a lot of value very quickly. The peso is today worth about 50% of what it was in January.
Yeah, so, I mean, I kind of get the feeling that Argentina seems to face a crisis like this every 20 years or so. I mean, I think back to 98 to 2002 and the crisis then in Argentina. Am I wrong?
No, that's exactly right. And it's curious to talk to people in the streets of Buenos Aires, because you get a sense that had this been happening anywhere else in the world, I think most people would be quite alarmed and, you know, taking drastic measures. But Argentinians have been through every single problem you can have in an economic textbook. So they're pretty calm through all of this. Many of them have made their savings, they've made their alternative plans. It seems like Argentinians are ready for just any catastrophe that can happen.
Argentina is not the only emerging market either to be facing fiscal and larger economic problems. Like, what does Argentina have in common with Turkey, for example?
Both Turkey and Argentina have problems of high inflation. The difference is, though, that Turkey isn't really meddling with its interest rates, which is what people say that is the best way usually to tackle inflation problems. Argentina, on the other hand, raised its interest rates to 60%, which is almost madness, especially for, you know, someone in the U.S.
Sorry,
who's not
60,
used to
60.
Seeing interest rates. 6-0, exactly.
Wow.
It started by raising to 45% in May, and that didn't work. So just in the past 2 weeks, it raised to 60%.
So how worried are analysts about these local crises, like what's happening in Argentina, escalating into a global economic crisis like we saw 10 years ago?
Well, it seems more like a problem that is contained within Argentina. Argentina has been a very closed economy for the past decade. It hasn't been as much as a big player as it used to be in the past. And investors already took a lot of their money out of Argentina in the previous years. But there is this risk of contagion for the emerging markets. Right now, Brazil, Turkey, that you mentioned, and Argentina are all not doing very well. So there's always this perception that countries like Argentina, when they fail, when they default, they sort of turn all other countries into risky assets as well.
That's the BBC South America business correspondent, Daniel Gallas. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. British officials have identified two Russian men as suspects in the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter. Authorities say they're pretty sure how the suspects did it.
The police know exactly what these men's movements were. They've got them on camera. The harder part is establishing who ordered this.
The latest on the Novichok attack, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Remember this?
That former Russian spy and his daughter remain in critical condition at an English hospital after being struck down Sunday by what authorities now believe was some kind of poison. But investigators remain baffled, and some top British officials are now pointing the finger right at Vladimir Putin.
That's an ABC News report from March after Sergei and Yulia Skripal were found unconscious on a park bench in Salisbury, England. They were poisoned by a deadly nerve agent developed in the Soviet Union called Novichok. The Skripals survived, but it sparked a diplomatic shakeup with Russia. Fast forward to this week. British police say they have two suspects in the case, and they have names. Prime Minister Theresa May told Parliament today that the men work for Russia's top military intelligence agency, and May said the orders for the assassination attempt came from senior levels of the Russian state. For the latest, I spoke with my BBC colleague Frank Gardner from London.
The British police have done an absolutely forensic, blow-by-blow trail of exactly what their movements were. They know that they arrived, for example, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Friday, March the 2nd. They know the hotel they stayed at in the east of London. In their hotel room, they found traces of Novichok. They went on what the British police believe was a reconnaissance to the town of Salisbury in southern England on the following day, on Saturday. They took a train there. The next day, they came back and in what British police and the British government say was the planned attempted murder of Sergei Skripal, the former Russian agent. They then took a train back to London, and by midnight that night, they were on an Aeroflot flight back to Moscow.
Wow, a really detailed chronology of their activities. The British government seems convinced that these two men work for Russian intelligence. What is the evidence?
Well, here is the tricky part, because the police have done a very forensic analysis of exactly what their movements were. The espionage, the intelligence side of this, is a little bit more murky, as you'd expect. Now, Theresa May, Britain's Prime Minister, stood up in Parliament today, and it caused gasps of astonishment, this, that she was so outright in saying these men were officers in the GRU. That's Russian military intelligence.
But it will be hard, it sounds like, for the British government to make a solid case against the GRU.
I think it will be hard. And the one thing that, of course, is missing in this, which actually nobody here seems to be talking about, is the what I would call the metaphorical smoking gun. There is no CCTV footage or photographs of these men spraying this stuff. Now, I can almost hear British government officials saying, oh, come on, you're being naive. Okay, but that smoking gun isn't quite there yet. Russia has mounted an extensive information campaign, some would say a disinformation campaign, ever since this happened. They've come up with over 20 different theories as to how this could have happened. Sergei Skripal was a black marketeer trading in chemical weapons. Theresa May did it herself. I mean, all sorts of, you know, outlandish theories.
Yeah.
I think they've got themselves into a bit of a corner here, because whereas with the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in 2006 using polonium poisoning, that was done on the streets of London. They said, okay, these two people who you accuse of it, they exist, but you're not having them. One of them is now an MP in Russia, and the other's doing something else in Russia. In this case, today, they're saying, we'd never heard of these people. These names mean nothing to us. Well, of course they mean nothing to them, because they're aliases.
So British police say there's enough evidence to charge the men, but they're still asking the public for information. What more do they need?
I think if they can piece together any more bits of the jigsaw, you know, they can't account for every single minute of these people's time. Did they have accomplices, most importantly? And a really important thing, is there any more of this stuff stashed away? It's believed that this stuff was brought in, disguised as a perfume bottle, into the country, but they dumped it. They didn't take the residue away with them. They dumped it in a park in southern England.
What about extradition? I mean, these two men are in Russia. It's hard to imagine Russia would do that, but would they? Do they ever?
Under this Russian government, absolutely no chance. The Russian constitution does not allow for suspects to be extradited for trial elsewhere. Interestingly, Britain's Crown Prosecution Service, the equivalent of, I suppose, similar to the Attorney General in the States, they have said, we're not even going to bother asking Russia for extradition because we did it over Litvinenko and you didn't produce the two suspects. Now, Russia says, we're nothing to do with this, and we'd like to be a part of the investigation. British government has said, you've got to be joking.
With Theresa May's really forceful statement about connecting the poisonings to the highest levels of the Russian state, what will the British government do in response now?
I think their way ahead now really is diplomatic, and it's a very difficult one. They've done all the punitive measures they can do directly. They've expelled quite a large number, over 30 Russian diplomats and spies, including people who they think Russia didn't even know that British intelligence knew were spies, if you see what I mean, people who were deep cover agents. That bit's already been done. The task for the British government now, and this is difficult against the backdrop of Brexit, of Britain leaving the European Union, is to persuade its partners in Europe to freeze out Russia. That's not going to be easy, because you've got various governments wanting to get closer to Russia. Russia provides a lot of energy, a lot of gas to Europe. And ultimately, there are plenty of countries in Europe that would wish this whole nasty business would go away. Now, the U.S. ambassador has already tweeted that the U.S. stands shoulder to shoulder with Britain on this. I am still be very interested to see if that statement will be echoed from the White House.
That's my BBC colleague Frank Gardner speaking with us from London. Thanks very much, Frank.
Thank you. Cheers, Marco.
Lots of unanswered questions and finger-pointing have followed another assassination attempt. This one apparently was successful. It happened last week at a cafe in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine when an explosion killed Alexander Zakharchenko. He was the leader of the unrecognized pro-Russian Donetsk People's Republic. Moscow blamed Ukraine for the bombing. Ukrainians say it was a result of internal rivalries between pro-Russian rebel groups. So who did it? Ukraine? Russia? And what does this all mean for the peace deal in eastern Ukraine called the Minsk Agreement? We'll get to that in a minute. First, who killed Zakharchenko? Alexei Horan is a professor of comparative politics at Mohyla Academy in Kiev.
One of the versions is Zakharchenko, he knew a lot, maybe too much, what was going on in the occupied Donbass. He knew who organized the shot of MH17. So perhaps he knew
too
much.
That's the Malaysian Airlines jet that was downed.
Yes, right. Perhaps this is one of the versions. So definitely, I don't know what exactly happened. What I would like to say is that Ukraine wouldn't gain much from the killing of Zakharchenko. I can say only that we consider this person to be a criminal who tortured many civilians, Ukrainian prisoners of war, and who actually killed many prisoners of war. The leaders of the separatists, or we in Ukraine call them actually terrorists, they are selected by Kremlin, they changed by Kremlin. Zakharchenko wasn't the first who was selected, but we shouldn't overestimate the importance of this figure.
The Kremlin says that Zakharchenko's death harms the Minsk Agreement, that's the peace talks between Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany, to stop the war in the east and Donbass. Does it?
From formal point of view, no, because the other leader was removed by Russia in fall last year, Mr. Plotnitsky, and nothing changed the Minsk process. Now there's no more Zakharchenko anymore. Let's explain the situation with Minsk agreements. Minsk agreements and Minsk process is trilateral process, okay? Trilateral. Who officially signed the documents? The documents were signed by Ukraine, Russia, and OSCE. At the same time, there are signatures of Zakharchenko and signature of Plotnitsky. But nothing is mentioned about whom they represent, okay? So just names. So that means that they signed in order to show that the separatists would stick to these agreements, but formally they are not part of the negotiation process.
Alexei, take this story about Zakharchenko and boil it down to one big thing it tells us about Russia today.
Russia can use the killing of Zakharchenko in order, first of all, to blame Ukraine, to have escalation on the front line, to undermine Minsk agreements, and to raise the issue of that, okay, this is Ukraine which is violating Minsk agreements, not Russia, so why shouldn't we remove sanctions from Russia? And we should understand that the sanctions against Russia, international sanctions, are connected to full implementation of Minsk Agreement. Basically, EU and the United States consider that, and the UK now, they consider that Russia is not fulfilling Minsk agreements, and that's why these sanctions are continued. Actually, Russia started the conflict in the Donbass, and Russia continued to use it in order to exhaust Ukraine and also to undermine European security.
Professor Alexei Horan, speaking with us from Kiev, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Those yummy cherries from Washington State are in grocery stores across the country, and soon we'll be seeing Washington apples and pears as well. Like much of the rest of the country, it's mostly immigrants who pick these fruits. In Washington's Yakima Valley, the pesticides that those workers are exposed to can endanger not just them, but also their children at home. Eilish O'Neill has that story.
It's 5 o'clock in the morning, and light is just beginning to show behind the brown desert hills that surround the Yakima Valley. Patricia and Javier just arrived to work at Sunrise Orchards. They're placing their ladders among the thick green leaves of the cherry trees. Patricia and Javier both came from the same town in Mexico, but they met in the fields of California when they were picking crops there. We're not using their last names because they're undocumented. Javier whistles as his fingers fly from tree to crate, pulling down clumps of cherries. He tells me he and Patricia like working here, in part because cherry picking is some of the easiest and best paid work they do. They can make $200 apiece in an 8-hour day. And, Javier says, the owners of this orchard don't use a lot of pesticides. But that's unusual. Javier says just 3 weeks ago, he and Patricia were working in another orchard nearby, where the pesticides were so strong, his wife got very sick.
Bien fuerte el spray picaba, le dio la alergia a Patricia.
Patricia's eyes teared up and she had to stop working. Her brother came to get her after she'd been there only an hour. The orchard where they're working today may have fewer pesticides, but Patricia and Javier still wear handkerchiefs over their mouths to protect themselves. They began taking more precautions when their daughter Azul got sick, when she was still a baby.
No podía respirar y cuando le daba mucha fiebre, la temperatura le subía demasiadísimo.
Patricia says one day her infant daughter couldn't breathe. She had a fever and her temperature kept rising. Patricia thought they would lose her, so they brought her to the emergency room.
Y se controlaba y a la siguiente semana la tenía que volver a llevar. Ya no podía respirar.
Patricia says doctors got the child's symptoms under control, but a week later, Azul stopped breathing again.
A los 5 años, ella habitaba en el hospital de emergencia.
By the time Azul was 5, Patricia says, her daughter lived in the emergency room. For many years, Azul didn't have a diagnosis, but Patricia noticed that the dust on her work clothes seemed to make her daughter's symptoms worse.
No podía llegar con eso aquí a mi casa y agarrar a mi hija.
Patricia says it was the pesticides on her clothes that were making her daughter sick, so she stopped working altogether. That meant the family was living on less than $500 a week. When Azul was 5, doctors finally figured out the little girl had asthma. That's become a big problem among children of farm workers, says Dr. Catherine Carr of the University of Washington.
You know, there's kids who have a lot of clinic visits, a lot of ER visits, hospitalizations.
Carr's a pediatrician who's been researching asthma in Yakima's farm worker communities. She says rural asthma is not well understood, but it's linked to pesticide use. And the problem is farm workers' kids are less likely to get their disease under control, and they're more likely to die from it.
We were interested in understanding asthma in this context in a rural agricultural community, which has not been a focus of most asthma studies, which take place in cities and in highly industrialized settings with lots of traffic.
Europe has banned many of the pesticides associated with childhood asthma, and they're on the decline in the U.S. as well. But in Washington state, they help control pests that can destroy entire orchards that are expensive to replace.
If you talk about a typical orchard of a couple hundred acres, we're talking about multi-million dollar investments.
That's John Devaney, the president of the Washington Tree Fruit Association. He says Washington farmers have been looking for less toxic ways to preserve their valuable crops.
One of the issues that growers have, though, is they need something with which to replace what's going away if they're going to be successfully growing a crop. And it takes a while for new products to go through that lengthy EPA review process.
First, put in your mouth, deep breath, and start blowing.
Back in the Yakima Valley, 10-year-old Azul is getting a breathing test from a community health worker.
More, less, perfect. Right there. You want it right there. Keep going. Keep going. Almost there. Keep going. Good job.
Adriana Perez is part of a regional study to figure out how best to control the asthma of farm workers' kids.
You need to be taking this one every day.
I'm going to come back in 2 weeks. To check if you're using it, is that okay?
Since the study began, Azul is doing a lot better. She rarely goes to the emergency room. Even so, her mother, Patricia, often checks on her in her sleep.
A veces me levanto en noche porque quedé así.
Patricia says she's still scared that at any moment her daughter could stop breathing. For The World, I'm Alicia O'Neill in the Yakima Valley.
Russian and Syrian jets are dropping bombs on the western edge of Idlib province. Idlib is the only remaining rebel stronghold in Syria. Russia's foreign ministry put out a statement today saying it was Russia's duty to fight terrorists in Idlib until their complete and final liquidation. Here's the thing. 3 million civilians are also still living in the area. Abdul Kafi Alamdo is an English teacher who fled the city of Aleppo in 2016. He now lives in northern Idlib with his wife and 2-year-old daughter.
These days, most people are scared about what might happen. More than 4 million are stuck here. What should they do? These monsters, they kill everyone. Children, women, all people. So people here, in fact, are really confused. We don't know where to go. Where should we go? Those powers, those presidents, who are allowing this to happen, knows where should we go. They don't care. Where should we go? To hell, to graves, to to die. They didn't care. All what they want to win, of course, win on our bodies. So these days, in fact, people are trying to defend themselves, to defend their lands, but people are scared, yeah, for sure. People are worried so much. People want someone to do something to prevent this? All people, even my daughter. Just imagine that my daughter, who should see now these days gardens, games, toys, might see fires, bombs, blood, destruction. I mean, what a life. What shall she remember when she gets older, if she could make it? I'm not speaking only about my daughter. This is the case of everyone. These days, my wife is having a new baby. Now, maybe this week, for sure, maybe the next. I'm expecting life, and I'm expecting death.
Residents of neighboring provinces are also worried about the assault on Idlib. We reached out to Ahmed Keja. He's a physician who manages a maternity hospital, and here's what he told us.
We are facing every day fears from direct targeting of our hospital here. That targeting will make people here without any medical support and will make them face death without any reason. Another fear that we have, we are fearing chemical weapons against our towns that will kill people and make their nightmares full of fears.
For another point of view, we contacted Elia Samo. He's currently a resident of Aleppo. We caught up with him in Beirut, Lebanon.
3 years ago, Syria was a swamp full of bees tearing each other apart in a jungle with no law and order. And thanks to President Assad, and we have to recognize that his persistence, his insistence, his determination to remain and see to it that Syria survive and has survived. It was very easy for President Assad in 2011, 2012 to pack up and leave. If you don't want me to be here, goodbye, I'm going to go. But he did not leave, and he remained persistently, insistently to make sure that Syria is what it is today. What it is today is relatively safe, relatively secure. I have spent time in Aleppo. You go out and come, and 3 years ago, you could not do that. Look, Marco, today is the first day of the rest of the life of Syria. Let's start now.
But what about the people of Idlib? Do they want the war to end with a full-on deadly assault of their part of the country by President Assad?
We have to put our disagreements, our fights, our problems in the past. We have to put that behind us. There is authority, legitimate authority in Syria, in Damascus, under the head, the leadership of President Bashar al-Assad. And his responsibility and duty, constitutional responsibility and duties, is to maintain Syria's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and unity. And that, therefore, he has to see to that it comes under the control and authority of the Syrian government. I hope to God that the procedure of regaining control and authority of Idlib will be humane, civilized, without much damage to the poor people, many of whom, both millions in Idlib, many of whom were uprooted once. And that's heartbreaking. Let's resolve it peacefully and let the Syrian authority extend its legal constitutional rights to govern Idlib.
It is heartbreaking, the situation that the people in Idlib find themselves in. Should they now be worried about dying at the hands of their own government?
In war, the citizens become targets and they pay a price of not their own making in their lives, in their family, in their possessions, or what have you. That's war, and people will suffer.
Three voices of Syrians, Aleppo resident Elia Samo there, and we heard earlier from Abdul Kafi Alamdo from northern Idlib and Dr. Ahmed Keja in western Syria. Next week, the world goes to Afghanistan, and yeah, the stories could have a similar tone as that last interview. But when one of our Boston-based reporters, Shirin Jafari, traveled to the Afghan capital, Kabul, she spent her time with women forging their own path in this country racked by war. Women are making inroads in the business world there. Take, for example, the fashion industry. And if you think that simply means what women are wearing under their burqas, think again. Shirin goes to a design studio in Kabul. The owner creates fashions that look like something you might find at Anthropology, streetwear with a traditional touch.
If you see Afghan girls walking around the street, they're very fashionable. They're very modern. There's still that conservative views that exist, but I think people don't really care anymore.
But working in the fashion industry in a country with social restrictions like Afghanistan, it's tough. Just ask one of the country's few fashion models.
We don't have security in general in Afghanistan, but being a model, a female model, is, you know, something more dangerous.
Afghanistan's growing fashion industry, just one of the stories we've got in the lineup for next week. By the way, you're hearing the sounds of Afghan star Ariana Syed. She's a songwriter and singer. She regularly tours around the country, despite the dangers. Also a TV host and known for writing about the struggles women face in Afghanistan. We'll leave you with a little more from Ariana Syed. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.